Finance and Revenue is open. We're going to go a little bit out of order from the agenda, and we'll do a public hearing and work session on the following bills, 2126, then 2652, and then 80. And we're going to carry over our work session on Senate Bill 663 to make some technical changes to these amendments. So we're not going to take up tobacco licensing today. We will start with a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2126. Before we call our guests up, we'll get a presentation from Kyle.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2126, the engrossed version, makes changes to an existing partial property tax exemption, the partial exemption for vertical housing. It's number 2.100 in the tax expenditure report. And the existing exemption, it's a 10-year partial property tax exemption, and it's at the request of a county or city to designate a housing zone, and then there's some oversight by the Department of Housing. And it's a partial exemption based upon the number of equalized floors. So it's for vertical housing, so it's multiple floors, and it's partial residential, partial something else. And the exemption is based upon the equalized floors of the residential portion. In the background of the SMS, I've listed the percentages. So for one equalized floor, the residential portion of the vertical housing would be 20% exempt, two equalized floor. Equalized floors, 40%, and so on, up to 80% for four or more floors. The land under the property can be partially exempt if the property, the residential portion of the property, is in some, at least partially used for low-income rental housing. So that's the existing exemption. It does have a sunset of January 1st, 2016, and that'd be for new properties coming on. Like I mentioned, it is a 10-year exemption, so those that started already would be able to get the full 10 years. But it'd be the new properties and the new designations of the zones that will sunset at January 1st. So in OLS, there is a listing under the meeting materials of the existing vertical housing zones. And I posted that, took that from the Department of Housing's website. But that's up there for those that want to see the number of zones that are out there right now. And so the changes that the bill makes is it adds the definition of non-residential use for purposes of vertical housing development zone. Non-residential use is defined as any use that is not exclusively residential use. It also extends the sunset date for the existing exemption from January 1st, 2016 to January 1st, 2026. And then one of the changes is right now under current law is local taxing districts can opt out of allowing the partial exemption. The changes in House Bill 2126A would allow any taxing district to opt out. So it's at the request of the counties and the cities, and there was an existing law would allow the local districts to opt out. With the new changes in the bill, any local taxing district, not just the special districts, now have the option to not participate going forward. So we do have the paperwork, the fiscal. There's no fiscal impact, and the revenue impact is there's no direct revenue impact because it is optional both on the city and the county first, and then any district can opt out. So it would be up to the local districts deciding whether they want to allow it or give up any tax revenue, essentially. Just to kind of give you some background on it, the existing loss, what was in the tax expenditure report for the 2013-15, was a total revenue loss of $200,000. And, of course, that's an accumulation of all the projects that are out there right now. So extending this, depending upon what the local districts would do, ultimately will frame what the revenue impact will be. But you could probably expect it somewhere around less than $100,000 for the first biennium or two going out, and then maybe getting back up to the $200,000. But just for some frame of reference there.
Okay, thank you. Denny Doyle, Dwight Inte, Randy Tucker, let's start off with you guys.
Good morning, Chair Haas.
Good morning.
How are you? Members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear here today before you. For the record, my name is Denny Doyle, and I'm here as the mayor of the city of Beaverton and to present Beaverton's strong support for House Bill 2126A. As staff has reported, the bill before you does three things. First, it extends the sunset date for the Vertical Housing Development Zone Program until 2026. Second, it clarifies the definition of the non-residential portion of a project so that live-work projects qualify. And lastly, it clarifies that any local taxing district has the option to opt out. The Vertical Housing Development Zone Program provides an economic development and revitalization tool for many cities across the state of Oregon, including Beaverton, Central Point, Eugene, Grants Pass, Gresham, Klamath Falls, Hillsboro, LeGrand, Medford, Milwaukee, Monmouth, Oregon City, Roseburg, The Dalles, and Springfield. This program works because it creates an economic development and housing in targeted areas of cities where the cities think it makes sense. The cities that choose to create the zones give up a portion of the local property tax when a project is certified. We do not take this lightly, we do it strategically. Simply put, the Vertical Housing Development Zone program helps a mixed-use project pencil out by offering developers a 20% property tax exemption per floor of development, up to 80% maximum exemption of the building value. An exemption on the land value is available if the residential portion is affordable housing. In both cases, the maximum length of the exemption for any project is 10 years. The Vertical Housing Development Zone program cannot be renewed or extended for a project which has had the benefit of the 10-year exemption. In Beaverton, we strategically designated three targeted areas of the city for this development with an emphasis on housing density. These are areas in Beaverton that have remained underdeveloped for years and years or have development challenges. Beaverton has two projects just getting started in the downtown zone that are on publicly owned land, land that currently brings in no tax revenue. After these projects are built, we and other property tax-funded special service districts in the city will start getting revenue from day one on both of these new improvements. And in one project, they will be purchasing the land from Beaverton, returning it to the tax rolls. In addition, we will be gaining tens of millions in construction investment. We believe this partial tax exemption is a wise investment on our part. The Vertical Housing Development Zone program will be an important part of the revitalization of our downtown, but the sunset date needs to be extended for that to happen. As I mentioned earlier, and it bears repeating, we do not give up property taxes lightly. We do it to leverage economic development and desired density. This is an opportunity for cities around the state that choose to use this type of incentive program to meet the housing and economic revitalization needs of their communities. Please join me in support of HB 2126A, and thank you for the opportunity to comment. I promised I'd be brief, and that's it. Any questions for me?
Okay. Go ahead. We'll save our questions for the end.
Good morning. My name is Dwight Untai. I am the president of Tokola Properties. It's a real estate development, construction, and property management firm. It's been operating in Portland or in Oregon for nearly 30 years. I'm here this morning to strongly urge you to extend this vitally important program. I can report to you directly as a developer who has actively used the program that it is an important tool without which these critically important revitalization projects would not occur. Our two most recent projects, 3rd Central in historic downtown Gresham and 4th Main in historic downtown Hillsboro, both utilize these programs, and I can report that without the Vertical Housing Zone program, these projects simply would not have been possible. I can also tell you that we're actively in discussion and negotiation with other communities around the state where they have reemerging historic Main Street districts that vitally need revitalization. And this program helps produce a catalyst that gets those first one or two of mixed-use, transit-oriented, typically programs going. So I tell you again or ask you again to please support the extension of this critically important program. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'd just like to build briefly on the testimony of Mayor Doyle and Mr. Untai. Metro has a program called the Transit-Oriented Development Program, which is geared toward supporting the kinds of projects that are also supported by the Vertical Housing Program. And I'm here for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'd like to draw your attention to the written testimony that was submitted when the bill was in the House by our planning director, Alyssa Gertler, and specifically to the project profiles that follow her letter of support. And they They have little graph, you know, pictures and project information, including information about the two projects Mr. Untai just mentioned. What those profiles show you is how this kind of development that really does revitalize downtowns, especially in suburban communities outside of the core of downtown Portland, which does not use the program, those projects need a variety of different kinds of support to pencil out. So there's often a partnership that involves local government, regional government, metro, state government, and the federal government in many cases to make these things work. But when they do work, they bring a lot of vitality to communities where they appear. There's some information about the project in Hillsborough that Mr. Untai mentioned that indicates that about 125 residents were expected to each spend about $15,000 on food and entertainment in downtown Hillsborough once the project was completed. So that's the kind of benefit that these projects bring. The other thing that I'm here to talk about is the change of definition the inclusion of the definition of non-residential. And that is intended to make it possible for these projects to include live-work spaces. In some cases, if you had ground floor retail requirement and then residential above, some of the market might not be there for the ground floor retail, and those spaces may remain empty. But a live work unit can bring the kind of activity to the area that the project is intended to bring, and so by providing a definition that says that if it includes any non-residential use, it qualifies as non-residential. It provides more flexibility for this program to bring those kinds of uses to these projects, and often over time then the market will change and you will get a full-on retail use in that space. And the rules right now don't allow uses that are not fully non-residential to qualify as non-residential. I think I got that right. Anyway, I'll stop there and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think this is sort of continuation of what started years ago as up is better than out philosophy. Mr. Unta, I was wondering if you could just fill me in on the consumer demand for this, where the consumers like. I mean, it's one thing for downtown Portland. It's another thing for suburban areas to have, six stories and people. Where are the consumers and the retailers in these kinds of developments?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because it is really, really important. The demand for this product is significant. And really what it's driven by in what we've experienced is that people do not necessarily want to leave their suburban community where they currently reside or perhaps have deep roots and have lived in a single family home for many, many years. But unfortunately, in many communities, they do not find an alternative housing opportunity that's appropriate. And what we're finding the demand for is these folks are seeking to stay in their community. They would love to return to the Main Street district, but they need typically secured building access, elevator service, one-level living. So a significant portion of the demand comes from those existing residents in these various communities that really don't want to leave. But there's also the other side of the demographic spectrum, the millennials, and not all millennials live in downtown Portland. A lot of them would also like to remain in their respective communities, but they don't see that urban-edged more current and modern living opportunity. And this program is just essential to allowing the creation of that type of product and introducing that type of product in communities across the state.
Thank you. Senator Voelkos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm perfectly fine with the bill, but I have a question for Randy because I know I'm going to be asked this question. This has got a really odd vote in the House in both the committee on the floor. I mean, you got
The no's in the committee on the revenue side over there were two Democrats and two urban Democrats and one rural Republican, and the floor vote's about the same way. So I'm certainly going to be asked in caucus, why were the no votes there, and what is the hidden issue or something here? I mean, you're the professional here versus the other two guests. So help me, how am I going to answer that question since I'm going to vote yes for this thing?
Okay. Well, I can't divine the thinking of particular members exactly. I think that, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I think there was a concern on the House side about the impact of the loss of revenue for school districts or whatever. You know, obviously we made, or the Gwen Baldwin, who has been leading the effort on this, led the effort to get the amendment to allow school districts to opt out, which is embodied in the bill before you. So I think there's some concern about that. I think there's a concern that this sounds very urban, even though, as you can see from the list of communities, oh, it's not posted anymore, but it's on the materials. There are communities around the state, including in areas that you don't think of as urban, who have utilized this this program. Really, it's an optional program that no one's required to use, and as I mentioned earlier, it is not used by the city of Portland. It's the kind of thing that is needed in places where the rents don't necessarily support this kind of development without some sort of a public subsidy. But as Mayor Doyle pointed out, it's a winner financially from day one. It's a positive revenue generator from day one, and then there's a big bump when the tax exemption expires in year 10 or after year 10. So, you know, it's a good program. I think you can vote for it without apology or. And as you know, it has a track record. It's not a new program. We're just making some minor tweaks here and extending the sunset.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment: the 4th and Main project in that Mr. Untai has done in Hillsborough is a great project. It's really done wonders for that area downtown, the historic district. And to answer your question, folks are already moving into that building, and I think there are folks who are moving in are folks who like the idea of being able to walk to the restaurants. And there are some really nice restaurants in downtown Hillsborough, so it's a great place for that kind of a development.
Yeah. So you're inviting us there to come spend our money.
I am.
That's what I thought.
Build on that $15,000.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you. Mayor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep Beaverton normal.
I'm not touching it. Thank you.
The legislature's working on making Oregon weird.
I'm sorry, Aaron Doyle.
This white male minority committee.
It's normal for Oregon. It's
good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities, here in support of House Bill 2126. Instead of repeating everybody else's testimony, I'm going to hit on a couple of things that are maybe a little less metro-centric. But the first thing I wanted to point your attention to is all of the letters of support in OLIS from a variety of perspectives across the state. We have letters of support from Grants Pass, you know, Medford, Hillsborough, Gresham, but we also have a number of cities that you would not particularly think, oh, vertical housing, that's going to occur in Central, in Central Point. But Central Point actually had two projects that came out of this program that created three levels of residential development. And if you look at Grants Pass's letter in support, it talks about the particular project that occurred there that was very important for them in getting that downtown revitalization. A lot of our non-metro cities that are smaller are looking for ways to revitalize the downtown area. A lot of business communities try to come together to create incentives for bringing business downtown outside of that 9-to-5 hour. And that's through things like restaurants and movie theaters and things like that. But it's hard to drive people into a downtown area when it dies as soon as that restaurant closes its doors. So by doing something like a vertical housing development zone, you can incentivize having folks living in that downtown area as well as working and enjoying the entertainment options or other business opportunities. The other thing I'd like to point out is this program's not just for new development, but is also for rehabilitation of current structures, which is where some of these programs have been very important, where you have someone who wants to do the commercial investment and there's a second floor, and if they just make some minor to major improvements of that residential area, they can drive even more rents and different types of housing options in cities that might not otherwise have it. Senator Boquist, to your question, I think there were a number of issues for different folks. Some folks had expressed concerns about incentivizing things that should just be done, but we all know that incentivizing things that should be done is sometimes necessary in order to make projects pencil out. Local governments also benefit from day one, as has been said. It's not that we give you 100% of all your investment. We give you 20% of the land value per floor, and maybe an additional 20% on the land if you're doing low-income housing, which is an additional incentive that the local government can focus on. The other issue, I think some people just hear vertical and get scared that we're going to try and even, you know, restrict further with land use or something and try to only go up and never accommodate single family housing when that's what the market's calling for in a particular area. I don't think that the communities that invest in this are doing this in order to prevent the market from working its way through the process of what residences are necessary, but are trying to find ways to do the economic development that means something for their community. And I will say that this need to extend the sunset didn't come to the league first from the city of Beaverton. It actually came from the city of Tigard and the city of Springfield independently. And then the city of Beaverton took the lead because they were working through the program. And so the league has kind of been riding their coattails, but also been very supportive because there's a lot of support across the state. Grants Pass has told me that they're looking about possibility of another zone. I've heard from the downtown development group in Klamath Falls that they're going to try and work with the city if the city is amenable to have another zone in Klamath Falls. So this is a program that is found ongoing use, and many people across the state want to see this sunset extended. And for that reason, the league supports this extension, and I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Questions, Ms. Doyle? Okay, thank you for your presentation. I have no one else signed up here at this public hearing on House Bill 2126, so I'll close the public hearing, and I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2126.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2126A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2126A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2126 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Bartschinger was yesterday, Haas is today. I'll carry that bill, and we'll close the work session. Thank you. We're awaiting a couple of state legislators, but we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2652. Kyle?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2652 will also be making some changes to an existing property tax exemption, the strategic investment zone. What the measure will do is it changes the definition of rural area to mean area located entirely outside of an urban growth boundary of a city with a population of 40,000 or more, as the boundary is acknowledged on the date on which the application for the SIP zone is submitted. It will grandfather the existing definition for the current strategic investment zones and parcels of land on which the eligible properties are currently located. So any that are existing under the agreement will continue to receive their exempt in the same way. Takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment signing die. And I would just call attention, there's some media materials in OLIS titled Urban-Rural Distinction. And there I just listed the difference in the city population. So one of the, there's two primary changes in the bill. The first is making rural area designated from a city of 30,000 to 40,000. So there are five cities between 30 and 40,000, but only two of which will actually be affected, Grants Pass and McMinnville, and they're the ones highlighted in yellow. And that's reflective of the fact that Lake Oswego, Kaiser, and Oregon City fall into urban growth boundaries of a larger area, whether it's metro or the Salem-Kaiser area. But by moving the the amount from $30,000 to $40,000, you're essentially making, or the bill would make Grants Pass and McMinnville would become rural areas. So any project within the boundaries of those cities would be subject to the rural requirements rather than the urban requirements of the SIP zone. And down at the bottom of this same chart kind of displays the differences between the urban and the rural strategic investment zone. So you have the minimum investment requirement. So just as a brief reminder on how the SIP zone works is you a business will make a certain amount of investment and they'll be taxed on the minimum investment, whether $100 million or $25 million, and that above it is exempt from taxes. There are different community service fees and application fees, but you can see based upon whether it's an urban or a rural, the size of the exemption can be different depending upon the size of the project and even whether a project would qualify. If it's in a rural area and it's $50 million, then there is some exemption. If it's a $50 million project in an urban area, the minimum investment is $100 million, there's no exemption there. So by making the two changes, the one from the $30,000 to $40,000, and the second change, is going from a static date on which the urban growth boundaries are set on December 1st, 2002, to when it was set upon the application date, it would grab any expansion of the urban growth boundaries of a city would now be the new designation for urban and rural. And that leads into, on the paperwork side, the fiscal, we have that it's a minimal fiscal. On the revenue impact side, it's an indeterminate impact. And part of that is reflective. It would depend upon the choices of any investor, business investor, whether or not these changes would affect them. But if we look back in the history of the program, there would be two businesses that are in areas that were considered rural based upon the December 1st, 2002 date of the urban growth boundaries. But if the boundary had been set based upon the time in which they applied, they would then be in an urban area. However, any impact on revenues would once again depend upon the location choices of the business, and that's why it's indeterminate.
Okay. Representatives, come on up. Senator Corsick with Senator Vescovo.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Gorsick. I'm the representative for District 49, East Multnomah County, which is Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, North Gresham, and a little tiny bit of Portland. I am here today to speak with you about House Bill 2652. Basically, this bill updates our Strategic Investment Program, or SIP, and how it does that is to use current population information in distinguishing our truly rural areas from our urban centers. The program itself is designed to incentivize businesses to make large capital investments in our rural communities, which is, as you know, very, very important in this state. Currently, the statute freezes the boundaries for this program at the urban growth boundaries that came into effect on December 2nd, 2002. Unfortunately, in some areas, those boundaries no longer reflect the urban and rural areas of our state correctly. So this means that a rural program is, in some instances, being awarded to urban areas. The current confused classification misleads by altering a program that was meant to provide separate incentive levels so that rural development can be facilitated at different levels from the urban, as you just saw in the presentation. This distortion was born out of mistakenly freezing the rural boundary for the program at the 2002 UGB lines. It's obvious that the boundary should have been dynamic to be of benefit to rural areas, which is what this bill attempts to do. For state programs dependent on rural and urban classifications, I believe consistency is essential. HB 2652 brings the Strategic Investment Program's definitions of urban and rural in line with its counterpart, which is the Enterprise Zone Program. So this bill provides consistency and predictability for companies looking to invest in Oregon and fairness to the communities competing for their investment. So I hope you'll support myself and Representative Esquivel and others in voting for House Bill 2652. I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. The reason I support this is because of our sister county over in Josephine County. It brings Grants Pass into play. I'm not sure how extensive people understand the problems we're having in Josephine County, but the unemployment rate is high. The this assistance from government is high, and we just need to kickstart that economy over there with any possible way whatsoever in order to make it to where it's viable. You look at Jackson County, and this doesn't affect my district one iota because Medford has 75,000, but it does affect Grants Pass, and I think that's very important to Southern Oregon.
Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Just for the record, I do want to note that because Kyle highlighted that it does have an impact on McMinnville, and the city of McMinnville is supportive of this. And I would agree with our two esteemed colleagues from the House. This makes the rural SIP rural, and it makes it more of a functional tool that's more usable in rural portions of Oregon, which has not recovered economically in any form whatsoever since 2008.
Other questions? Senator Bircher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, for the record, like to thank Representative Esquivel for working on this. This is my district and my hometown, and I appreciate it. Thanks.
I guess that should make me a no vote.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment. This is a bill that I think is due. I testified on this bill over on the House side, and actually my city is the only one that is against it. But the fact is that it should be using current UGBs instead of one in the past as the defining line for these. Make it truly rural. If you're going to call it rural, make it rural.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Eric Chambers from the City of Gresham.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Eric Chambers. I represent the city of Gresham. I'll be very brief in my remarks. As the representatives very accurately mentioned, this is a reasonably technical fix to the definitional issue. It streamlines economic development programs so that the strategic investment program and the enterprise zone program operate under similar distinctions in terms of urban and rural. The problem in the status quo right now is that the definition of urban and rural for the purposes of this important economic development program have really nothing to do with the disposition of a community being either urban or rural. That creates two types of inequities. One is between similar jurisdictions within the same region that are operating under looking for urban SIPs, and then more notably that the incentive that was intended for truly rural communities is not available to them or is effectively mitigated because truly urban areas are able to offer the same incentive. Again, a very small fix that provides a pretty large increase in equity, and we hope that you'll be supportive of the legislation. Thank you.
Questions for the City of Gresham? This may be the last opportunity you have to ask the City of Gresham anything.
Thank you.
All right, we have nobody else signed up to testify on House Bill 2652. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2652 and open up a work session on House Bill 2652.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2652 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2652 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none, I'll go out of order here since one of these is your city's, Senator Bertschiger, if you'd
That's
like
fine.
To carry this bill.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2652.
It's good that I don't have to carry it, so my city's the only one against it.
As we change batters here. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 80, a cleanup bill with an amendment on deck that is 288 pages.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 80 obviously has been in work and in production for a while. It has to deal primarily with the cleanup from the university system, changing its coordinates with regard to the state and who works in what capacity. So Senate Bill 80 has been a work with the different universities, and somehow you would hear from the universities. OHSU is here, and Oregon State University attorney is here for questions, but it seems like you know, our cradle of an intellectual treasures are a little shying away from talking about this bill for somehow. It's not a complex issue enough for our research to be done on it. However, in order for all of this to work, instead of me going into this difficult issue without guide, we have legislative counsel here, Dan Gilbert. He would go in an overview of what the bill is, why is it needed, and what kind of solutions they've been working with to the point of making all these general big idea issue solutions, and then also the small technical ones. So if you'd ask him to come to the table, he would go very thoroughly, well, as thorough as you want, I guess, with 290 pages.
Yeah. Well,
he's not going page by page, is he?
Actually, are you done?
Well, sure, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I'm done.
I do want to call Dan Gilbert up, if for no other reason, just to, I don't know, congratulate him on the birth of this. He's been working on this for the better part of 2 years after the last 4 years of higher education restructuring, and it left a lot of unresolved issues. There's no more chancellor's office. There will be no more university system, and some of the statutes still refer to those agencies. And so there was a massive cleanup here, and that is no small words, and it wasn't even, he couldn't even finish in time for the education committee to resolve all some of those issues when they had to pass out bills. And so that's how come it got sent over here, and so that's why we're ending up with a higher education bill, because we're a full service revenue committee. We do higher education, tobacco, and taxes.
Certainly feels so, that way, yes.
But really, Dan, you've been grappling with this for a long time, and I know you have a whole new appreciation for the bonding world after this. But perhaps you could give us an overview of what you tried to do with this over the last year or so and clean up.
Yeah, absolutely. Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert. I'm an attorney at Legislative Council. So I'm here to talk about the Dash 2 amendments to SB 80. As Chair Hess requested, I think that's first I'd just like to summarize the context for them. So they really are intended to be cleanup amendments, and we worked very hard to limit the policy that would be changed at all by these amendments. So this cleanup was necessary because in 2013 we passed Senate Bill 270. This removed University of Oregon, Oregon State University, and PSU from the Oregon University system and granted the institutional governing boards to run the day-to-day life of the universities. It also created a pathway for the technical and regional universities to pursue obtaining their own institutional governing boards. Last summer, all four of the technical and regional universities were granted authority to establish their own institutional governing boards, and this becomes effective on July 1st of this year. So as of July 1st of this year, it means that all seven public universities will have their own institutional governing boards. Also means that as of this date, the Oregon University System, Office of the Chancellor, and the State Board of Higher Education will cease to exist in any meaningful sense. But there are hundreds of references to these entities throughout statute. So the Dash 2 amendments try to address each of these references to those entities in a way that as much as possible leaves current policy choices intact. So they do this in three main ways. The first is in sections 1-4 of the bill. Declares the dissolution of the Oregon University System, of the Office of the Chancellor, and of the State Board of Higher Education. Section 4 includes the repeal of more than 100 associated statutes and session laws that result from this. A second part are purely or conforming amendments, and they're the main reason that this draft is so long. In general, what these do is they track the references to Oregon University System, the Chancellor's Office, and the State Board of Higher Education in statutes that are not being repealed, and they replace them with references to either a specific university, to public universities in general, or to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, depending on which seems most applicable. The final part of this bill, and the part that took the longest really to complete, relates to bonding and funds. And it's, you know, there is a lot of bonding authorities that have involved the State Board of Higher Education, Oregon University System. There are a lot of funds, in particular the Oregon University System Fund, that have been created over the many decades that these entities existed. And it's trying to make sure that we can transfer, that people can keep using these monies, and that we keep everything intact and the way that policy makers have already decided things in the past. To do this, we solicited comments and worked with representatives and bond counsel from the universities, from Treasury, from DAS, LFO, just trying, and we did this with the assumption, with the understanding that, again, we would try and keep we would not try and make any policy changes in this bill. And without trying to speak for any of those other entities, my understanding is that people are generally have generally been okay with how these bonding and fund provisions now work, with the important caveat that there are numerous other policy bills discussing these that are in play. In particular, with respect to bonding, there is House Bill 3199. Everyone has agreed that to the extent that those policy bills would conflict with this cleanup bill, the policy bills would prevail. So,
all right. Well, thank you for your work on this. Senator Boquist has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I voted for to dissolve the thing, and I think I even voted against HEC. I'm looking back there for So I just want to make sure that I'm curious, because and the reason I voted that and changed my position to going to the bonding boards is it's time for the seven entities to sink or swim in the 21st century in specific terms of liabilities, because we have had several of the not major but several of the seven in less than desirable financial situations. If one of these regionals or even a major entity of these seven actually fails, because you've done the intricacies of the bonding liability, and there are still bonds that are outstanding, do we, the legislature, inherit the bonding liability that would be remain, say, hypothetically, and I don't want to beat one of them, so we'll just say hypothetically the University of Burns, which of course does not exist, failed. And those bonding, and they had bonds that were still outstanding for construction, so on and so forth. Does the legislature inherit that, or what happens? Or is that one of those you need to get back to me later?
That's one of the ones I'd have to get back to you on later. I will say that again, what I can say with certainty is that this bill would not change that liability. That it is what would happen in the current state right now. And I know there are several concerns about whether about how the relationship between the university's bonding and the state should work that are being dealt with in other policy bills right now. But I can get back to you.
If I'm sure, I would like to give you back, because we have several of those smaller institutions that have financial challenges, and as the millennials and the other groups, as we see, are having less children. There's going to be less people going to schools, doesn't matter, K-12 or universities, out in the future, 10, 15 years from now. And the question comes down is, if one of them becomes insolvent, what is the liability issue? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you confident you've got everything?
Chair Hass, Senator Baird Sugar, I am. We have gotten as much as we have been. I will be surprised if there are not things that people ultimately find later. But I will say that we have spent a lot of time trying to find everything we could.
Reasonable answer.
It was a Dan Gilbert answer. Very careful.
It was a legal answer.
All right, Dan, thank you again for your hard work.
Mr. Chair, I understand the State Treasurer will also would want to testify, asking that there are certain tweaks that are still to be done.
State Treasurer, would you like to come up?
Tweaks or tweets?
Morning, Committee. My name is Drew Johnston, for the record, on behalf of the Oregon State Treasury. Mazin, what did you, a few tweaks to this bill, or? No, we're mostly good with SB 80.
We just a lot of us saying.
I think we're basically there with SB 80. We're in support, and we just wanted to. And later on in the House committee, we'll be talking about House Bill 3199, which we're almost ready with the dash 3, which really is where we fill in the gaps with the bond administration that deal with a lot of Senator Boquist's concern of where is the state left, you know, going forward on this program. So,
okay. All right. Thank you, Drew.
Yep.
Oh, hold on, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same question. You don't need to answer it, but I do want an answer to the bonding liability from the State Treasurer's Office that I asked Council about.
Yes. And so for I need to go back on for legacy bonds, but going forward, those will not be, you know, the liability of the state. And so we'll make sure we've got a more complete answer on those bonds we've previously made.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Janet Phillips from OHSU.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Hass, Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Janet Phillips. I'm the General Counsel for the Oregon Health and Science University, here to testify in support of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 80. 20 years ago, in less than a month, OHSU was restructured by you and your predecessors as an independent public corporation with a public mission. And really, the ties to OUS were cut at that point, with a couple of important but not very voluminous remaining ties to OUS. And now, with the dissolution of OUS and with all of the state universities kind of following the lead that we set 20 years ago, our remaining relationships need to be restructured as well. We're very satisfied with how that's been handled in Senate Bill 2. Senate Bill 2 was our public corporation bill. You can tell it's still in my head.
We've often said around here that some bill numbers should be hung from the rafters.
Yeah.
Those numbers should be.
That's what, like retiring a jersey. So we're very satisfied with the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 80, very appreciative of all the work that staff and the members have put into this, and that's why I'm here to, what I'm here to report. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for OHSU? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, committee. No one else has signed up to testify today. We're not going to take action on this bill today, but you can peruse it. All 288 pages of it tonight as your homework assignment, and we'll look at a work session later this week or next. So that clears our deck for today. Thank you. We are adjourned.